Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you with us on WPR News. And it's time to talk about native plants with our guest, Neil DeBole. Neil is president of Prairie Nursery, co-author of The Gardener's Guide to Prairie Plants, and certainly recognized internationally as an expert in native plant community ecology. And we'll talk with him about when to start cleaning up in your prairie garden. We can take a look at seed, why soil type is important to a successful garden, and, of course, answer your questions as well about native plants to your landscape. Maybe you're looking for recommendations for natives for a specific area, perhaps, or other questions. Give a call. The number's 800-642-1234, or you could send an email to talk@wpr.org. Neil DeBole, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Larry Mueller, our very own national treasure right here in Wisconsin. And I got to tell you, it is always an honor and a pleasure to be with you on Garden Talk. So great to be with you, Larry. Thank you.
Always great to talk with you. And I know people are itching to get out into the gardens. When we think about a prairie garden, cleaning up, when's the best time to clean up a prairie garden?
Well, of course, this all depends upon your goals. But the worst thing you can do, as far as wildlife, insects, pollinators, the worst thing you can do is be a neatnik and go out there and cut everything down and throw it in the compost pile, or worse, put it in a plastic bag and put it out by the curb. So if you look at what we call landscaping for life, debris is diversity. And it's really the dead plants are really the staff of life, because so many of your pollinators, butterflies, moths, and other insects and invertebrates overwinter in plant material or in the ground, very close to the ground, or actually in the ground surface under leaves. And it's incredible, different invertebrates overwinter as eggs, as larvae, as pupae, as adults, in the duff, in the leaves, in the stems, in the seed pods. So when people go out and remove everything, they're basically removing the next generation of all these cool critters that visit our prairie gardens and other ecosystems on our property. So if you want to encourage as much diversity of, again, pollinators, insects, and invertebrates, you want to wait as late as possible in the spring to either burn your prairie, which is the best maintenance method as far as stimulating native prairie flowers and grasses, or to cut things down and remove them to encourage soil warming and thus growth of the primarily warm season prairie plants that like to have open, bare soil to stimulate their new growth. So you want to wait as long as possible for emergence of these various pollinators, invertebrates, etc. And if you can, take the cut material and lay it a little more thinly. Don't put it in a big pile or remove it from the property. Put it in the woods or somewhere where things can emerge and not pile it up 3 feet deep.
Yeah. You know what I did last year?
Uh-oh. Here we go.
No. I did nothing. I just let
That's
it go.
I...
And you know what? Everything came up. You know, I cut down some of the blue stem, sometime when things were starting to green up and pop through. Mm-hmm. I just cut down the stems that were kind of tall.
I'm so glad you brought that up, Larry, because this is what I do at my house. I try and, when possible, I've been kind of stymied by the weather with burn bans and snow in April and stuff like that. But the absolute best way to manage a prairie for a variety of different priorities is to burn or cut half of it in any given spring, usually in mid to late April. Because at that point, that's right when the prairie plants start to come up. So you want to remove the plant material just before the plants come up so you don't damage the prairie plants. But by leaving half of it stand, as you did, that leaves all the homes. You're not a home record. You leave the homes for all the pollinators, et cetera, to come out. And so, yeah, it looks messy, but see, that's just a human construct of what is messy. I like to look at the dead plant materials. There's nothing more fun than going out and doing CSI botany by looking at the dental records of the plants in the middle of winter. So, but it's so important. And you know what else? If you leave a lot of those tall standing stems, those are singing perches for breeding birds. So if you have like coneflower stems or pale purple coneflower or wild quinine, some of these really strong stems, compass plant, these become really important for the sex lives of your songbirds. So you don't want to deprive the birds of having sex. Come on, let's be kind here, you know. So there's all sorts of reasons to leave maybe half standing and then remove the other half. And why do we remove the other half? In a larger prairie, we don't want woody plants invading that, which commonly happens in our climate where we get plenty of rainfall to stimulate the growth of woody plants. So we want to cut that, saplings, seedlings, et cetera, back so that we don't have those sorts of invasion issues. So a compromise like that is really the way to go.
Coneflowers was mentioned. Keith in Eagan, Minnesota emailed. He has some coneflowers and rattlesnake master seed spikes that have been standing up all winter. If he cuts them and lays them on the ground, are they now ready to sprout or do they need to lie still, lie in the ground for a winter?
Those cows have left the barn. So those seeds, I tell you, coneflower seeds usually drop within a month after they ripen in October. So usually they're on the ground by Thanksgiving, and those that did not drop were probably eaten by birds, which is another reason why you leave your coneflowers up over the winter, or so many different species. Many of them will retain their seeds later into the season, and birds will use them as winter food. And some of these plants actually hold them all the way into January and can provide a very important emergency food for birds, especially when the ground is covered with snow. If you have standing stems that still have seeds in them, that can be really important for overwintering birds to stay in our region without migrating.
Gail in Burlington says she has a part of her yard that she would like to start native woodland area, adding shrubs and plants. It's shady with trees already established. She'd like to naturalize it using natives, but of more woods forest habitat. Can you recommend books or an organization for helping plan this? Well, you guys do that, don't you?
Yeah, absolutely. What I would do, and there are all kinds of books out there, and to focus on woodland plants. You know, we've been, my co-author and I, Hillary and I, put out this Gardener's Guide for Prairie Plants, which only took us 22 years to put together, and people are clamoring for a woodland book, and we're like, we'll be dead by the time we get that one done. But there are a number of plants out there. I'm not sure exactly how many are still in print, but I would just do a quick Google search to find what different books there are. Books I have, you know, they go back to the, you know, late Pleistocene. So some of them are a little bit dated, and books do tend to go in and out of print. So I'm trying to think if there's a really good book on woodland gardening, and I'm sure there are some good ones out there. It's not coming to me right now, but
maybe I will.
Yeah, I think that we think it's just to see what's going on, because there's new books coming out all the time on this too. It's almost impossible to keep up with it. So
you'll be answering a question at some point, and then you'll say, "Oh, I just remembered this book."
I hope you're right, Larry. I'll work on that.
Oh man, a listener in Crawford County emailed to say they have a prairie in Crawford County that was installed in 2001. Their seed was heavy with big bluestem, and they would like to reduce it where they can, using some wood betony.
Yeah, wood betony.
Yeah, but in recent years, they've had tall Indian plantain creep in and is now proliferating. They try to pull it out and also clip off the seed heads, but it is a battle. Any recommendations?
Yeah. Well, on the big blue stem, the particularis, the wood betony, is like hemiparasitic on big bluestem, and it's been proven to reduce the density of big bluestem. They have to get that plant established, and here's the issue, is once big bluestem and any of the taller grasses like switchgrass or Indian grass become dominant, they have such dense root systems and they're so tall that it can be difficult to get other species established because the soil is completely occupied by their roots, and also the foliar layer is occupied by these tall grasses. So they would want to go in there and rough up the soil so they can create some openings. You can just go in there, my goodness, in big bluestem, you can go in with a disc and just disc it and rip it up and then seed your wood betony seed. There are other options for this. You can reduce the vigor of the prairie grasses by mowing the whole prairie down, usually in late July or early August. this is the point at which these plants are starting to send up their flower stalks. And so their roots are at a weak point because they're taking the energy out of their roots to produce their flowering stalks. And so you can mow them every other year in early August. That will reduce their vigor. Now, it would also reduce the blooming of your late season flowers like asters and goldenrods. But the early blooming species will tend to have enough time to set seed and not be affected, bloom and set seed. So you do it every other year so you don't deprive the plants, later blooming plants, of their ability and opportunity to bloom and produce seeds. This takes a long time, but the best prairies in the United States, the best remnant prairies are in Missouri on these rocky soils that could not be plowed, and they were typically hayed, again, in late July or early August when they had maximum production of the grasses once a year. And so that helped to stimulate the flowers by reducing the vigor of the grasses. So that is one strategy. Another strategy is to go out and actually apply an herbicide, a grass selective herbicide such as Cethoxydim, commonly sold as Post, POAST, or Clethodim, CLETHODIM, commonly sold as Select is a common name. Marketed as Envoy Plus, ENVOY Plus. And you can spray when the plants are actively growing in July, and that will not kill them, but it will really set them back. And if you do this for a couple years in a row, you can reduce the vigor of the grasses without harming the flowers because the flowers are not affected by grass selective herbicides. So there's a couple of strategies there. If you can get the wood betony established, I do not have experience with this. I've only read the professional papers where people have studied this, and it can be very effective. But you would normally want to establish it at the time of the planting of the prairie so it has an equal opportunity to grow and become established and begin limiting the big blue stem at the outset.
Okay. And that tall Indian plantain creeping
Yes. That is, the Indian plantains are very interesting. Most of them are pollinated by wasps, including parasitic wasps. So the plantains are really important ecologically for controlling other insects, pests, etc. And it's interesting because some of the plantains are fairly rare, but in some situations they can be quite aggressive. So the thing to do with those is to prevent them from going to seed. So if you can go in there and cut the seed heads off right after they finish blooming, just go in there and whack the seed heads off. Do not allow them to form seed. And you don't have to remove them from the site. You can just cut them off because right after they finish blooming, the seeds will not be mature. So there's no need to bag it up and remove it. That's just extra work. And if you cut plants after they finish blooming, they typically will not rebloom. Most species, there are a few exceptions, but the vast majority of them, if you cut them right after they finish blooming, they will not rebloom, the seeds will not form, and you can eventually prevent them from reseeding, and the original plants will eventually die.
Neil DeBole, our guest today, president of Prairie Nursery, is a consulting ecologist. His book, co-authored The Gardener's Guide to Prairie Plants. You can join in with your questions. The number to call, 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on WPR News. Next week on Garden Talk, we'll be taking a look at growing berries, and Vijay Pandian will be back for that. But right now, we're talking prairies, and Neil DeBole, our guest from Prairie Nursery. It's great to have Neil back. And again, call in the number. We'll get you on pretty quickly at 800-642-1234, or email to talk@wpr.org. James in Wales emailed. He wants to start his first native prairie garden with flowers and grasses, and he'd like to use a seed mix. Can he till up the area this spring and plant, or does he need to go through the year-long process of smothering out the existing vegetation?
That's an excellent question, and it all hinges on what the existing vegetation is that he has to eliminate. If it is a beautiful bluegrass lawn with no weeds in it, then yes, he can go in there and till it up. He'll probably have to till it two or three times repeatedly in order to kill the sod, where you would go out there on a hot, warm day when it's not going to rain shortly thereafter, like during a high-pressure system, and till it up until it two, three times across to really break up the sod. This is going to be hard work. Tilling up sod is hard work. That's why you need to go across it two or three times to really chop it up. Then let it sit in the sun to dry out. Now, that's not necessarily going to kill it. So you'll have to come back after it starts to green up again, usually in a few weeks, assuming there are some survivors, then till it again to really annihilate it. And you might have to do it a third time a couple of weeks later. So it's about a one-month process, tilling it three times every 2 weeks. That should usually remove that lawn. The other choice is to go in with a sod cutter and simply cut the lawn off and remove the sod and then till the soil below it. You'll have a little bit of a sunken area, but in a few years, you'll never know the difference. So that's an easier, or it's a quicker way to just get a sod cutter, rent a sod cutter, cut the sod, and remove it. So if you have lots of problem weeds, perennial weeds, especially rhizomatous weeds like quackgrass or smooth brome grass, if it's like an old field that's been just grown up wild, that is going to take 1 to 2 years to really get that under control. So tilling is really difficult because all it does is chop up those rhizomes and spread them around. It's almost like kind of like a propagation method. Oh, let's get some more of these guys going. that system, and I have done this, and you do it all summer long. You go out there and till it once a month all summer long, starting in April, May, June, July, August, September. And that will almost always kill rhizomatous perennials, grasses. The exceptions to this are things like Canada thistle that has roots that can go up to 2 feet deep, little runners. If you've ever dug Canada thistle to remove it, I had to do that once. I fallowed my garden, my veggie garden, and Canada thistle got in there, and I had to dig it out. I had to go 18, 20 inches down to get the runner roots. So it's really hard. Tilling will not kill them. They'll just resprout endlessly. So it depends on what the vegetation is that you have to eliminate. Smothering is another option. You don't have to till. You can smother. That's a lot less work. And for some people, they will go out and they will apply glyphosate, basically Roundup, every 2 months, usually once in late May, early June, and then again in mid-July to early August, and then a final application in September before seeding in the fall. If you have an area that has a really long history of a weed infestation, you may have to spend 2 years of site preparation because there's all the weed seeds in the ground. It gets into all kinds of details where tilling is not as good because every time you till it, you bring up more weed seeds. This is one of the reasons why herbicides are actually superior as far as killing weeds, is that you don't till the soil and all those weed seeds in the surface of the soil are being killed as they germinate over a period of a year or two. So you're actually reducing the number of weed seeds in the soil, and then you will overseed. You will seed by not tilling. You put a no-till method down, and if you seed in the fall into this killed area, and you don't have to dig anything, you don't have to take anything off the property like sod cutter, you just kill, and put your seed down into the dead turf in the fall and then cover it with about 2 inches of clean winter wheat straw. And that winter wheat straw will hold the moisture in the soil the following spring when those seeds germinate. A fall seeding is a dormant seeding. Very little, if anything, will come up in the fall. That 2 inches of straw will reduce and pack down to about 1 inch of straw, which will almost be like a little layer of topsoil over those seeds that are sitting on the surface of the soil, and they will come up right through that straw.
Wow. Ken in Green Bay has a question for you about burning, I think. Ken, hi.
Good morning. Yes, Neil, when you burn, you're going to burn all the seeds that have fallen off over the winter. And then how often do you burn? Every 2-3 years?
Those are excellent questions. You don't necessarily kill all the seed that has fallen. And it depends upon many, many factors. Remember that the seeds will oftentimes work their way down into the soil through the action of frost heaving over the winter. Now, this presupposes that you're burning in the spring. If you burn in the fall, the chances of burning the seeds are much higher because they're still at the surface level, and they're more likely to be damaged or killed by the fire because they haven't worked their way down into the ground. Also, in the fall, the soil tends to be drier because you don't have all that moisture left over from the spring melt or from spring rains. It depends. It might be a wet fall, so it's not always the case. But the drier the soil, the deeper the fire will burn and more of the seeds, the newly dropped seeds, will burn. So a lot of factors come into play. Oftentimes you'll see that you can burn in the spring, and if the soil is damp and the litter is damp, you won't burn even all the way to the ground, and that's where the seeds will be protected from the fire. So it doesn't always necessarily harm the seeds because it depends on many factors. Yeah. When to burn? This is a really, really important question. So it depends on what your goals are. Okay. If you want to prevent the invasion of woody plants like buckthorn, honeysuckle, autumn, olive, my worst problem is black walnut. The doggone squirrels plant them. I've got buckthorn. My neighbors have buckthorn, honeysuckle, autumn, olive, all this horrible stuff. I have almost no problem with that in my prairie. I burn my prairie. I try to burn it every other year. Most woody plants, if you burn them and burn them hot down to the ground, every other year, any seedlings that germinated will be killed. After the third year, they have sufficient root systems that many of them will survive a burn if they've had 2 full years or 3 years of growth. The exception, of course, is a black walnut. It only takes 1 year because it has such a deep root, and then you're screwed. Okay. So if your goal is to prevent woody plant invasion, you really want to burn every other year. And this works perfectly, like you talked about, Larry, about leaving half of some of your plants stand. If you're doing this every other year, half and half rotation, where you just leave everything stand, you can do 1 year, half of the prairie standing, and you burn the other half, or mow it if you can't burn. Then you rotate back. So the next year, you burn the side, the half that you didn't burn the previous year, and leave the other side stand. So you also have issues with cool season weeds and grasses like quackgrass, bromegrass, white clover, red clover. Some of these can be really problematic in a prairie. And if you don't burn for 3 or 4 years, they often can become very dense and overtake your prairie plants because the cool season non-native weeds and grasses start growth 4 to 6 weeks earlier than the vast majority of your prairie plants. So they get a head start and they get a jump on the prairie plants, which are mostly warm season plants. They don't start coming out of the ground usually until, you know, late April or May. Things like butterfly weeds sometimes won't even show up until June, depending upon the spring. So these cool season grasses, weeds, et cetera, can start growth 4, 6, even 8 weeks earlier. They lock up the foliar zone. They lock up the moisture. They lock up the nutrients. And they're burying the poor little prairie plants that are trying to emerge. So burning after those plants come up, usually in late April, when the buds of the sugar maple, somewhere between when the buds of the red maple and the buds of the sugar maple are opening. If you have earlier blooming prairie plants, you want to burn when the buds of the red maple are opening. If you want to, if you have more warm season plants, you can burn when the buds of the sugar maple. The date varies, so we go with the plants. The plants never lie. They follow the same program. So the red maple usually opens up about 10 to 14 days before the sugar maple. So you'll get better weed control if you burn when the sugar maple buds are opening, but some of your early emerging prairie flowers are going to get burned back. Does it kill them? No, but it will kind of slow them down. Okay, so there's what I do. I try and do it every other year. Sometimes it's not until every third year because of weather variations. Some people don't want to burn too often because they're concerned about damaging invertebrates, butterflies, etc. So that's, again, why you rotate if you want to do it every second or third year.
You know, as you were talking, I was thinking back to an interview I did not too long ago with a DNR fire warden who's written a book about fires, and he was talking about in his county there would sometimes be in the spring 16 calls a day for fires that had gotten out of control. And a person needs to get a burn permit in most places if you're going to do this, don't you?
Yes, most counties require a burn permit. It's really interesting. The burning regulations vary from county to county. And I'm assuming that he was probably in a central Sands County like we are here in Westfield and Marquette County where everything can get dry really fast. Was he from the central Sands?
He was from the New Glarus area.
Oh, New Glarus, really? Okay.
Even that many fires in a day.
Wow. See, we have very dry, sandy soil, so things dry out so fast that wildfires are a constant issue here. Most of the fires here, most of the devastating fires are people burning their trash improperly.
Yeah, yes, true.
And it's not so much prairie fires, because most people that are doing prairie fires, they know what they're doing. They've got their permits. They've studied it. They've got fire breaks in place. They've got water. They've got equipment. They're not dummies. They're not these people that go, oh, burn the trash, and then a flaming piece of paper goes into the grass, and it's gone in seconds. Okay. So, yes, but you do need a permit. And let me tell you, if you lose a fire and you have a permit, it's not good. But if you lose a fire without a permit, it is really bad. It's going to cost you a lot of money.
A lot.
And a lot, especially if there's a structure involved. Okay.
So, or more.
So, and the reason for the permit is mostly so people read the directions and the regulations so they know this is how you do it. But for people that want to know more about burning, they can go to our website.
Yep.
And there's a section called Learning Center. And if you click on Learning Center, it's on the far right side, and then you go to Download Center. That'll show up when you click on Learning Center. That's in the lower left, Download Center. Click on that, and there is a paper that I wrote called How to Burn Your Prairie Safely and Have Fun, Too.
And I think I was mistaken on the location. I think it was from Spring Green area.
Oh, okay. Yeah, they see a lot of sandy soils over there. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. New Glarus has more loamy soils, so loamy soils hold more moisture. In southeastern Wisconsin, they let you burn in the middle of the day because it's clay and it holds moisture. Where we are in central sands, you cannot burn until 6 p.m. because later in the day. And this is why you don't want to burn during the day. Burn in the evening. The temperatures are lower, making conflagration and ignition less. You also have higher relative humidity. You have lower wind speeds in almost every case, unless you have an unusual meteorological event where a front is moving in or something. So that's why we cannot burn until 6 p.m. And it's really interesting. At my house, I had a little bluestone field. If I had lit that on fire at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, it would have exploded. I tried to burn it one night at 10 o'clock. I had to put gasoline on it, and it went out. It wouldn't burn because it was covered in dew.
Yeah.
The plants were covered in dew. I could not get it to burn, even by pouring gas on it. So that tells you how important the timing of the day is for that. In the middle of the day, that thing would have just erupted, but at night, it was unburnable.
Jim and Stevens Point has something. Let's go there. Hi, Jim.
Good morning. I have an opposite question from one you answered earlier. I have more flowering plants, and I would like to encourage the grasses. So if you could tell me the opposite recipe for encouraging flowering plants.
Sure. Jim, I have a couple questions for you. Are you on sandy soil?
Yeah, Stevens Point area, yeah.
Okay, so it's sandy soil. How old is your prairie?
5 years, maybe.
5 years old. And let me guess, you seeded it in the fall, correct?
I did, yeah. Yeah, whatever you recommended is what I followed your directions, yeah.
Yep, and seeding in the fall, and this is really interesting. This is something I think it's important for listeners to know, is that fall seedings tend to favor the flowers over most of the warm season prairie grasses, whereas a spring or early summer seeding in April, May, or June tends to favor the warm season prairie grasses over some, not all, of the flowers. And sometimes what we will see with a fall seeding is we can have very low germination of the grasses and excellent germination of the flowers. It depends on many factors. But something happens to those warm season prairie seeds, like little blue stem, big blue stem, Indian grass, Psidotes grama, something, there's predation of them or some sort of loss of viability when they sit in the soil over the winter compared to being seeded freshly in April, May, or June. So how to address this? Do you have enough fuel to burn this prairie, Jim?
Yes, I think I could now, yeah.
Okay, so here's what you can do to favor warm season grasses over flowers. Wait until late in the spring. And when I mean late in the spring, I mean into May, okay? If you have sufficient fuel to be able to carry it through the greening up of the prairie flowers. Most of your prairie grasses don't come up until May. So they're going to be just barely starting to grow. And they will be minimally damaged by burning in mid-May or later. If you find that you have so much green growth is like the control rod in a nuclear power plant. They're the control rod in a prairie burn. You can have some fuel, but if you have insufficient fuel and lots of new green growth, it will not allow the fire to progress because the ratio of green moist material is too high. So if you can't burn it, you can mow it right to the ground. I mean, get a lawnmower out there or something. It'll go right to the dirt. And now what you're doing is you're removing the growth of the prairie flowers, but doing minimal damage to the prairie grasses. And prairie grasses, also, their growing points, with the exception of switchgrass, all the prairie grasses have growing points underground. So when you cut them down, you're doing proportionally way more damage to the prairie flowers, which have growing points in their apical meristems at the top of the plant. The grasses have their growing points in the ground because they're accustomed to being grazed by bison and elk and whatever. So they're able to recover much more rapidly after a mow or a burn event. So go in there and mow your prairie on June 1st, May 15th to June 1st, and do that for a few years in a row and see if it doesn't change the balance of the grasses to the flowers.
Yeah, and you know, grasses, prairie grasses, I think, are important in a native garden, are they not?
Well, it depends on your goals. You know, a native garden versus a native meadow. And there's a real big distinction between a garden and a meadow. Because a garden, you're tending. And so assuming that you're going to give the garden some maintenance, you know, the grasses become less important ecologically than in a prairie meadow that you seed, because the grasses help to control the weeds. And it's the dense, fibrous root systems of those grasses that occupy the soil. And where do weed seeds germinate? In open soil. The grasses close it down. They just shut down. They're the defensemen. Okay, they go in there and they're shutting it down because there's no place where those grasses are for seeds to become established. Very rarely, okay, proportionally. So the grasses not only do that, they also provide structure for your flowers. They provide lots of interest in the fall and winter when the flowers are done. And they're interesting in that they also, if you have a rich soil, they will suck up the nitrogen so that you don't get these big, tall flowers that flop over because the grasses help to reduce the nitrogen level.
Margo in Stoughton has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Margo.
Hi, thanks for getting me on. I'm calling on behalf of my stepson who lives in Rock County. He recently bought some property. This isn't necessarily a prairie question, but he recently bought some property, and it's got a very sloping, shaded area that he cleared. And it was just scrubby, junky. I'm not even sure what was in there. And he sent me a link to your no-mow grass, and I wondered if, A, that was a good recommendation on your part. I think his end goal is just little or no maintenance. And once again, it's very shady. And then if it is a good recommendation, what else he would have to do to prepare for sowing, or if you have a different recommendation for that area.
Okay, this would be a long process, but let me just give some basic ideas. And then I would say, why don't you just have him give me a call here at some point, and I'll be more than happy to go into the details, but I don't want to take up too much time here. But let's talk about, this is a really super important topic that you brought up here. What happens after you clear scrub, brush, et cetera, from a woodland area, and then you want to plant something new? There's a process involved here. So if we look at, oftentimes what we're clearing is usually, not always, but usually invasive plants, many times non-native, things like buckthorn, honeysuckle, autumn olive. I keep using the same ones, but these are the bad dudes, okay? And, you know, we've got all sorts of new nasties moving in, okay? So now we have oriental bittersweet, which is a vine, which has come into Wisconsin the last 10, 15 years. So clearing all this out, and then we have some of our own native plants that are also aggressive, like prickly ash, which is a very unuser-friendly plant. It is, of course, the host plant for the giant swallowtail butterfly, so you don't want to remove all your prickly ash if you want to have giant swallowtail butterflies. But when you're walking through your woods and your face is getting ripped off, you kind of want to get some of that stuff out of there. So I have lots of experience with that. I dig it out by the roots, which is really fun. But at any rate, so after you clear everything, you think, oh, boy, I've got this new fresh palette where I can plant something. Not necessarily so, because there are probably eons or many years worth of seeds lurking in that soil that are going to germinate. So you want to be super careful about just going in and planting something and then finding it engulfed with buckthorn seedlings. And I have seen buckthorn seedlings literally like 100 per square foot after being cleared of buckthorn in the previous year. Oh, just like dog hair stands, solid stands on the ground, at least 100 per square foot. Yes, that's an incredible amount of buckthorn seedlings. But and, of course, other invasive plants will do that. And that doesn't even take into account garlic mustard, if you have garlic mustard, because that can compete heavily with whatever you seed. And garlic mustard is allelopathic, meaning that it uses chemical warfare to suppress the growth of other plants. Studies have shown that garlic mustard greatly reduces the germination and survival of most native trees, including oaks, hickories, etc. So you got some really badass dudes out there that you need to be able to control prior to putting your seed down. So you have to, first of all, know what the species were that were cleared. What is the residence time and viability of the soils, of the seeds in the soil, and how long will you have to kill them off before you can seed what you want? And then if you're on a hillside, you can't just go out there and spray everything and have a naked hillside where the soil runs down. So you have a lot of considerations on how to approach this. So it gets a little fairly technical. But to answer the question about the no-mow grass is composed of fine fescue grasses. These are not native grasses to our region, but they are adaptable here. I researched for many years using buffalo grass, a native grass to the Great Plains, for lawn substitutes, which is touted by all these people. Oh, buffalo grass, native lawn, not native here. It grows out in Colorado and western Kansas. Okay? So it grows where it gets 15 inches of rain here. Well, guess what? It doesn't work here. Okay, it gets completely engulfed by other stuff. So then I said, oh, my God, what will work? And, of course, there are these fine fescues that are used for lawns. I didn't invent this thing, but we researched this with some turf experts, and it is a great option for non-clay soils, and it does very well in semi-shade, not deep shade, but semi-shade. It's the best turf mix for semi-shade. The Achilles heel of this, however, is that in the shade, you must either remove the leaves at the end of the growing season, or they will smother the turf, as they will any turf, or go in with a mulching mower and chop them up very finely so they will deteriorate and not smother the turf. But whether or not that's appropriate for this situation, many factors come into play, and I would suggest that your son-in-law give me a call, and I'll be happy to help him directly.
And you have your, what's your 800 number?
Oh, it's 800-476-9453, which is 800-GROW-WILD, G-R-O-W-I-L-D. And I hate it when people give you these letters because you can't figure out where they go with the numbers. So it's 476-9453, 800.
All right. Margo, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. Mary emailed. She has a very sunny, dry hilltop border that she'd like to plant with more clumping grasses and forbs that don't get out of control. She knows a prairie drop seed is a great option, but she can't seem to find other options. Do you have other options?
Well, it depends on when you say lower growing. There are really, for clumping grasses, prairie drop seed is the ultimate. It is so aesthetically pleasing. It has great form, beautiful, thin, deep green leaves, nice, airy seed heads. It's called prairie drop seed because the seed drops very quickly after it ripens. They should have called it prairie emerald fountain grass, but, you know, the people who named these things were not into marketing. So the other good lower clump forming grass is little blue stem, which gets about knee to waist high. So it's a little taller than the prairie drop seed, but it turns a beautiful crimson red in the fall. Okay, it brings great color to the garden. Even it's still kind of a washed out orange even this late in the season. So it always has some interest for you throughout the seasons. Another grass that is not really a clump former is called side oats grama, S-I-D-E oats, O-A-T-S, grama, G-R-A-M-A. And this gets about 2 feet tall. It's very beautiful grass, but it's not really a clump former. It's just really kind of a clump former, but also tends to spread out. But it will look in the garden like a clump. It is not as long-lived as prairie drop seed and little blue stem. Prairie drop seed, I know plants that I planted 45 years ago that are still extant. So, and they could live 100 years or more. Who knows? We don't know. Little blue stem lives for decades. Side oats grama usually persists for about 10 years. It does not grow in clay, but you have a dry soil. That's perfect. It loves dry soils. And it tends to need a more alkaline soil. It doesn't seem to do well in soil pHs below 6.5 that tend to be more acid. So be careful if you're in an acid type of soil. It has beautiful little seed heads. It's absolutely gorgeous. And it actually has it actually has flowers that are quite visible. Most people don't think of grasses as flowering plants. But if you look at the flowers of side oats grama, they're fairly significant with a little orange stamens and white female flowers. Indian grass also has very distinct flowers, so they actually do show up. So those are your three best grasses. There's one other grass for dry soils, and it's an Aragrostis, Aragrostis spectabilis, purple love grass. This is a clump former. It turns a beautiful pink in August, September, but it has detachable seed heads that blow around. And one of the old names for this grass is petticoat climber, because it'll crawl up your petticoat. Not that I would know, but it crawls up my pant legs when the wind blows. So this seed heads blow around, but it's absolutely gorgeous pink in the late summer. It really is, and it only grows on really dry sandy soil, so dry sandy and rocky soil. It absolutely loves it. So, and it's pretty long lived. It's pretty long lived grass. So get yourself some petticoat climber, purple love grass.
Oh, man. Neil DeBoll, our guest from Prairie Nursery. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on WPR News. Thanks for joining in for Garden Talk today. Larry Mueller here talking prairies with Neil DeBole, president of Prairie Nursery and co-author of his book, The Gardener's Guide to Prairie Plants. Russ in Belleville has a question or a comment, I believe, for you. Let's go there. Russ, hi.
Yeah, thanks for taking the call. Good to hear you again, Neil. This is Russ Hefty, a blast from the past.
Hey, Russ, how's it going, man?
Good. I thought I'd share with you a no-till technique that we use in the conservation park where we had the existing cover of bluegrass and brome grass, and we started off by doing a fall burn. Then we used a no-till drill to drill in the native seeds. Then what we did was over a period of years, we would burn late spring when the brome was growing, but the prairie plants weren't growing, and the prairie plants were there, and they sat there, and they sat there, and they were vegetative, putting down a good root system, not flowering, and then we hit a drought year, and it's like you flip the switch, and now you'd never be able to tell that that wasn't planted into a clear, pure piece of, you know, herbicide ground. It worked amazingly successful, but it only works in bluegrass and brome grass because you can deal with those. Can't do it in quack or reed canary. It just won't work.
It didn't work. It wouldn't work in quack, you don't think, huh?
I haven't tried it, but, you know, I know it works in blue, and I know it works in the brome, and, you know, it was next to a remnant, so there was some native stuff that had been exposed and was still growing, and we just didn't want to. I've had very bad experiences in other places where we had an old field that had been there forever, and mm-hmm. we nuked it with Roundup twice. Mm-hmm. And you would have thought we had planted a Canada thistle.
Oh, wow. Oh. Yeah. Yeah. You know, that's really interesting, Russ. One of the issues that I've seen is that when you look at the relative fire tolerance of cool season grasses, bluegrass, Kentucky bluegrass, and quackgrass, their fire tolerance is low. They're easy to control with mid-spring burns. Smooth brome grass is a real problem. I've noticed this on my prairie. I can control bluegrass, fescues, Kentucky bluegrass and quack, but that smooth brome recovers so fast from a fire. But you had an unusual event, probably it was a drought of 2012 that turned the switch for you.
2005, like I said, we had burned the after we planted every spring after the brome mm-hmm. had greened up for three mm-hmm. or 4 years. Then we had the drought, and it flipped the switch, and now you'd never know that was ever a solid non-native cover that we started out with.
And you burned every single year up until that point?
Correct, yep. We'd wait until the brome grass greened up, and then, it bothered us. Yeah, we kind of got a hint of that because we had some kids in one of our parks that set off fireworks in mm-hmm. the middle of July in a brome grass and bluegrass field. You could tell for 2 years where that circle of that fire was, because it hit at a very vulnerable time.
Sure. And, you know, you can do this with all those cool season grasses and reed canary grass. One of the great methodologies for controlling reed canary grass is to burn it in mid-June when it's in full bloom. And it completely smokes it. And if you have sedges and wetland forbs in there, and I've used this method. It was in the literature. I didn't invent this. I just followed the literature and burn it in mid-June, which is the smokiest, nastiest, most acrid smoke you will ever, ever experience, because it's burning all that green leaf material. But my God, it was just like Russ, like you say, flipping a switch. And by August, it was all sedges, and there were sedges that were underneath all the reed canary grass and a number of native forbs that showed up, and the reed canary grass was still just knocked right on its hinder. So,
Russ, thank you.
Fire's a great tool.
Yeah, thank you, Russ. Appreciate the call. Al in Abrams, we'll go to you next. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, Neil. I've got a question about all the proliferation of solar farms. About, is there any recommendations for native plants that you could put underneath these large solar farms?
You know, that's a great, great question. And we work with a lot of solar farms. And in the more open areas, on the south side of the panels, we have what we call our low-growing prairie mixes, which are plants that are mostly 1 to 3 feet tall. So you're able to be under the panels. But when you get underneath those panels, it's a whole other game. So what a lot of people will do is they will actually plant our no-mow lawn mix underneath those because they're perfect for indirect sun that comes from the north side in underneath the panel itself. But obviously prairies are by their very nature sun-loving ecosystems. They need at least 50% direct sun per day in order for the grasses to thrive and most of the flowers. There are some shade-tolerant prairie flowers that grow also in woodland edges and savannas, and you can use those, and you can use sedges instead of grasses because there are sedges that are shade-tolerant, so you can mix the shade-tolerant prairie flowers like purple coneflower. There's a number of different ones. Bergamot. Bergamot is surprisingly shade-tolerant. Zizia, the golden Alexander, a lot of these will grow in semi-shade, and you can mix those with sedges if you want it to be all native. But sedges are more expensive than the prairie grasses, so that mix is going to be more costly than a prairie mix in most cases. So there is an option for that. If you're in really dry sandy soils, you get more limited as far as what species will grow in shade as far as prairie plants, because most of the prairie plants that grow in shade are more mesic or medium soil species. You get in the dry sands like you have up in the Abrams area, it becomes increasingly difficult, and a lot of the sedges are more mesic, and you only have a couple of woodland sedges that will grow in dry sand.
Al, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. And Larry in Two Rivers, what's on your mind?
Hi. My question was, what plants grow well under white cedar or red cedar, and maybe a recommendation for wetland species that would grow in ridge and swale?
Okay, well, white cedar casts one of the densest shades of any one of our native trees, white cedar and sugar maple. They have such a dense leaf area. There's a concept called LAI, Leaf Area Index, and that's how many layers of leaves there are from the top of the tree to the ground level. And you have such a dense shade under white cedar that it's really hard to grow much of anything. But there is one plant that will grow there, at least one, okay, and that's called wild ginger, Acerum canadense. And this is just my observations in nature where I work in these diverse woodlands, and you come up to the white cedars, and there's only one species under it, and that's the wild ginger. So if you're looking for an extremely shade-tolerant plant, wild ginger is a choice. Now, wild ginger requires a well-drained soil. If it's a wet soil, like in a swale, forget it. It will not grow there. It'll drown. It does not like moisture. It also seems to prefer alkaline soils. So if the pH, again, is below 6.5, 7.0, you may have some difficulties in it. It really loves dolomite and limestone. Eats it up. I grew it on my property on my hillsides, which are about 85% rock. In order to install anything, I need a jackhammer or a pickaxe, and they will grow in that. If I have to dig the rocks out, put the roots in, and put some dirt over them. So that's the only plant I know of that'll grow under that.
And wet conditions, was it?
Wet conditions under white cedar, I have no, that's really tough. And I honestly can't answer that because I don't have any experience in that area. See, and red cedar is a totally different game. So red cedar, and it's really interesting, if you go over by the Spring Green area and look on the south-facing slopes as you're driving down Highway 14, those hills used to be prairies, and now most of them are completely covered in red cedar. And the Nature Conservancy has property there that they have cleared, painstakingly cleared, acres and acres of red cedar. And underneath it, they got it in time in most cases, and there were prairie plants that were just barely hanging on. And I've worked in situations in northern Illinois and southern Wisconsin with the same. And you clear those red cedars, and now you can bring the prairie plants back, especially with fire. If you want to keep the red cedars, but you want to have something to grow under them, then just limb them up 5 or 6 feet or above your head so you don't poke your eye out with those branches, and you can then establish plants that will grow in semi-shade. Even a lot of prairie plants will if you limb those trees up 6, 7, 8 feet tall.
There you go. Larry, thank you for calling. Kristen in Madison called with the name of a great book with woodland gardening information. It's titled The New England Wildflower Society Guide to Growing and Propagating Wildflowers of the United States and Canada. William Colina is the author of that book. So it's a long title. Maybe we can post that up on the Larry Mueller Show page.
I should have thought Bill's book, of course. How stupid of me. Yeah.
All right. Neil DeBull, our guest today, and he's going to be with us right up until 12:30 today, or at least to the bottom of the hour. We'll be taking your calls, and I hope you join in. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on WPR News. You're listening to Garden Talk on WPR News. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Neil DeBoll, president of Prairie Nursery. Great to have him back. And certainly, if you have questions, join in. Give a call. We'll get you on pretty quickly. Maybe you're starting or maintaining a native plant garden, or maybe you're looking for some plant recommendations or other questions as well. Give a call. The number 800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@WPR.org. And Perry in Oconto needs some advice, Neil, so let's go there. Hi, Perry.
Hey, Neil. I really appreciate how you have your share your plant knowledge and also how it affects the ecology and nature and stuff. So thank you for that. Here's my question, or here's my problem. I have a... It's on the east side of my house, but it's mostly sunny most of the day. And I have a gate. And that gate area where you walk through just gets ripped up. I have a dog that runs through it like 60 miles from 0 to 60. And is there any kind of grasses that I could put in there that would be, you know, kind of stable for that high traffic area? It's probably about 3 by 4 feet. Area.
Okay, and this is a sunny area?
It's mostly sunny, yep, most of the day.
Okay, and do you have typical sandy Oconto soils?
We do.
Okay. Well, the toughest grass, well, one of the toughest grasses is good old Kentucky bluegrass because it forms a dense sod and it is very traffic tolerant. Unfortunately, it needs a fairly rich soil. It doesn't do very well in sandy soils because it needs lots of water and lots of nutrients. And sandy soils tend to be low in those two things. Our Nomo grass is only a medium-tolerant traffic grass. It's perfect for your soils, but it would not stand up to this kind of dog activity. Another option, but it's a little rougher grass, is called turf-type tall fescue. It has a broader leaf. It grows taller. Needs to be mowed more often if you want more of a lawn-like look. But turf-type tall fescue is about as tough as they come, and it'll grow in almost any soil. It's got to have sun, but it's rougher than Kentucky bluegrass, broader leaves, kind of coarse, but it's really tough. Okay, but like anything, you got to give it time to get established before your dog starts. It's 0 to 60 in 3.7 seconds.
There you go, Perry. Thank you for calling. Dave in Appleton, what's on your mind?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I do have two questions. The first one is, how do I prepare my soil, which is lawn right now, in an area about 15 by 40, to be able to grow wildflowers or prairie flowers in it? Can I just turn it over by hand as far as deep as the shovel goes and then rake it out? Or should I use a sod cutter? What's the best way to prepare the soil? And then I have another question.
Okay, well, let's start with the first one. If you have the time and the energy, you can go out there and turn it over by hand. I've done plenty of that. It's great exercise. And you want to keep as much of the topsoil as possible. So what you do is after you turn it over, you get these big chunks of sod. You take make sure you have a very sharp spade, and you shave off the soil and to get it down to the roots. And then I turn my roots, those pieces that are left over, I turn them upside down. So the leaf side is down and the root side is up. And then I let it rain on it to wash as much soil off. And then I let it dry out in the sun. And then you can shake out all that soil. But you may not want to go through all that. But you want to keep as much of the topsoil as possible because that's where the best part of the soil is, the most organic matter, etc. That's the first step. Or you could get a sod cutter and just cut it off, which will go way, way faster. And you can cut it at about 2 inches, which will be about what you would get if you were to do it by hand and then shave it off with a spade. So you're going to end up with about the same result. So those are, and that will allow you to plant immediately. The only issue with that is if your lawn has quackgrass or other rhizomatous grasses, those rhizomes tend to go 3 to 4 inches deep, and you have to get those out or they will come back and cause you no end of trouble. And also, if you have quackgrass or other rhizomatous species like a creeping Charlie, oh my God, or white clover, these will creep in from the edges. Even if you completely eliminate them in the area to be planted, if they're on the edges, they will not respect that border, and you may want to put in one of those edgings. You can have, get aluminum edging or plastic edging to go around your garden to keep the invaders out. So the other choice is to spray it with Roundup or to smother it. For, if it's just a lawn, you can smother it in about 2 weeks. If it's a bluegrass lawn, you can hit it once in early May, and that'll take it out. So you have all those three choices there to do that.
All right. There you go, Dave. Thank you very much for calling.
He had another question?
Oh, sorry. Yeah, Dave, you had one more question.
Yes, well, thank you very much for that. As far as spending the time and labor, I love it. I don't mind doing it by hand, although I think I would be turning the soil much deeper than 2 inches. It'd probably be 4 to 6 inches. Do you still want me to pull out that grassy stuff or just bury it 6 inches, and then I'll get on with my other question?
So what exactly is growing there now? Is it a bluegrass lawn?
No, it's just all weedy grass.
Oh, my God. Okay, this is not necessarily a good strategy because it was weedy grass. Boy. Yeah, you're going to be digging 6 inches or more. You're going to have your work cut out for you. So get the backhoe out.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a hell of a job. That's a hell of a job. And if there are any deep-rooted weeds, you will not be able to completely eliminate them. Like Canada thistle is a real problem. It has, like we talked about earlier, has really deep roots. So that can be an issue for you as well. So know who you're trying to get rid of and then develop your strategy accordingly to make sure you're going to be successful.
And your other question?
Yes, thank you very much. So my other question is, now that I got the whole area established, I want to plant something in there that's going to be all flowers, all ground cover. I mean, like Creeping Charlie, but of course not Creeping Charlie, as low to the ground as possible. Might flower all summer long, easy to establish, establishes quickly. Can you give me 5 or 10 names of different flowers that would work that way?
Well, I can only do 3 miracles a day, so this is going to be tough. what I would suggest you do is go to our website, and on our website you can use filters. And so if you go to plants and seeds on the left hand side of our website, click on that, and then there will be a whole list of choices. So you can first of all click plants or seeds. We have different species available as transplants and different species available as seeds. So it sounds like you're going to want to put in plants, so click on plants. Then you can go down and pick your soil conditions, your drainage, your sun, and the height. And you can pick plants that are 0 to 2 feet tall, and it will give you, it will generate a list of plants that are adapted to your sun conditions, your soil conditions, your drainage conditions, your height, even your flower color. You can pick your flower colors, and you can pick benefits, i.e. what kind of, does it attract bees, does it attract butterflies, does it attract birds, etc. So you can then generate a list that's customized to what you want your garden to work for with those flowers. You can do the same thing with grasses, sedges, etc., but the flowers are the ones where you'll get the most choices to meet your needs. So on our website, you'll be able to find that and then generate a whole selection of plants from which to choose.
All right. Dave, there you go. Appreciate the call. Daryl in Bancroft, your turn. Hi, Daryl.
Hello. I collect maple syrup, and I tear the logging roads all up with big ruts, and then in spring I disc it, and in the past I tried planting clover and stuff more for a deer plot, but don't have any luck in the shade getting anything growing. You got a recommendation?
Yeah, that's really tough. Does the tree canopy cover your little roadways? Do the trees touch at the top over it so there's no sun coming through?
Yeah.
That's part of the problem there. If you're looking for something to vegetate, and you go in there every spring, right? You go in there every February, March?
Yep.
Yeah, okay.
Do you use it any other time of the year?
No, not just very seldom.
Okay, and so sometimes the ground is frozen and sometimes it's not, so it gets rutted up, like you said, right?
Yeah.
That is going to be a really, really, really tough one. And you're in Bancroft, so you probably have sandy soil, right?
I'm on bluff, so it's heavier. I got two plots on the flats at nice earth.
Okay, so you got sandy loam, loamy soil?
Yeah.
Okay, so there's a plant called pathrush, P-A-T-H. Pathrush will grow in the shade. And it's called pathrush because it grows in paths where the soil gets compacted and there's a lot of traffic. And if you want, you can give me a call at 1-800-476-9453 and ask for Neil. My extension is 235, and I'll be happy to talk to you about what we can do with that. It's not a seed that we normally offer, but it's available. It's really hard to seed because there's 2 million seeds per ounce, not per pound, per ounce, okay? So it's like dust, and it's really hard to seed. But this thing, it will grow. It is one of the few plants that will grow in an area where it gets heavy, heavy traffic in a wide variety of soils. So
there you go.
Give me a ring, and we'll see what we can do.
800-476-9453. There you go. Thank you so much. I appreciate the call. Listener in Green Bay called to just asking for advice for growing lupin.
Okay, what kind of lupin are we growing? There are a number of different lupins. Our native lupin.
Yeah, go ahead.
Do we have a scientific name for this lupin?
No, it's just general lupin.
General Lupin, okay, this is corporal punishment reporting for duty, General Lupin, sir. So if we look at the different species of lupin, you have our native Lupinus perennis, perennial lupine. This grows only in sand. This is the host plant for the Karner blue, the federally endangered Karner blue butterfly, whose last remaining stronghold is central Wisconsin, where lupine grows. So it has to have like 4, 5, 6 feet of sand. Not sandy loam, sand, or loamy sand. But, I mean, it has to be like, the soil has to be like 80% sand. If it's more than that, it just doesn't grow because it needs this really loose sand because it has a root that goes down many, many feet. In fact, when the native lupin is a 2-inch tall seedling, when you grow this in the ground, when the seedling is 2 inches tall above the ground, the root is a foot deep.
Wow.
Yeah. Because it grows in dry sand, and it has to get down to the moisture. So that's the first place it goes. I'm sure I've never done it, but those roots are probably 4 or 5 inches deep before it even sends up a leaf, a cotyledon, because that's its strategy. Okay, so that's our native lupin. It'll grow in sun, full sun, to partial shade. When it gets into more shade, it will still grow, but it will bloom less profusely. But it will hang on. What you often see is the savanna plant. So it grows in our dry sand prairies and sand barrens. And so it will grow under the black oaks, hills oaks, and other woody plants in sand barrens, but it will have reduced blooms. Now, we also have a lupin that grows along the shores of Lake Superior, and this is a non-native lupin that was brought here as an ornamental, and that will grow in richer soil. It likes cool weather. People grow them in their gardens, and so you can certainly get these and grow them yourself. So it's two totally different species. I've never tried to grow the ornamental lupin in sand. I don't know if it does, but I think it does because up on the lake shore it does. But I don't have any experience with growing that one. So they're two different lupins, so you want to make sure you know which one you get. The native lupin only gets about 18 to 24 inches tall, and the one that grows along Lake Superior gets about 3-4 feet tall. Very ornamental, very beautiful.
Oh, excellent. Well, Marion in the Twin Cities has a question, so let's go there. Hi, Marion.
Hi. Just recently, like last week, the city took down a huge maple tree that was shading a portion of my backyard. And it's just gone now. And that side of the yard faces south. So I've gone from complete shade to complete sun. And the things that were planted there that aren't going to make it, there were some ferns, some foxglove, some wild ginger, and they're just going to be gone.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yep.
So you want something for full sun now?
Right, but I have to deal with the fact that this is on the downslope side of the house, so it's a clay soil, and in the spring, it really holds the moisture. It dries out over the course of the summer, but in the spring, it's really wet.
Okay, and it's on the south side? It's a slope on the south side of the house?
It's not really a slope. It's just a gradual downgrade, but okay. It's... and then the other issue is the tree has left massive roots. So I'm not going to be digging out the roots.
I got it. Well, you have just been handed a very challenging situation. Okay. So let's look. First of all, you have the issue of clay soil. So that will limit what species you can use. Number two, maple trees are notorious for their surface roots, as you point out, and so there's not a lot of actual soil that you can plant into because these roots remaining from the stump are going to be there for many years to come. So you have to find plants that you can install by getting them in between the roots that will grow in clay in this new sunny area. So this is going to be tricky. Wow. Okay. How much square footage are you dealing with here?
It's not a large area. There's grass, and yeah, along side of the fence I have flower beds. In the part that had been sunny, not shaded by this maple tree, I have three ornamental grasses, and they'll do fine. But
you got a 10x20 or a 20x20 or?
There's one area that's...
Oh, you're breaking up. I guess we can kind of roughly figure the amount.
Yeah. Okay, let me give some suggestions, okay? So here's some low-growing plants that will tolerate moist conditions and dry-down conditions that are easy to install in a situation where you have limited rooting zone. One is called Nodding Pink Onion. It's a bulb. Actually, it comes in a pot, but it has a bulb. So it doesn't get real deep. The roots stay shallow. Okay, and that will tolerate moist conditions. There's also a plant called Prairie Onion, which is very closely related, but it doesn't like moist conditions. So you want to make sure you use the Nodding Pink Onion. Okay, another plant, which is a corm, which is just basically a bulb, is called Prairie Blazing Star. It does not need deep roots either. All of these grow in clay, in full sun, in moist soils that will dry out. Again, that's Prairie Blazing Star. That's one of the Liatris Pycnostachya. And if you can get a big enough hole dug, you can put in purple coneflower, good old Echinacea purpurea, which will tolerate quite a bit of moisture, as well as much drier soil conditions, and its roots tend to be fairly superficial. Another plant that has rhizomatous roots is called bergamot, Monarda fistulosa, and it will grow in full sun. It tolerates moisture. It tolerates dry. It is broadly adaptable. All of these are perennials, and it does not need a deep rooting situation. So there are a few plants right there. Oh, and one more, Ohio goldenrod, which is not native to the Twin Cities. It's native into southeastern Wisconsin, but it grows just fine in that area if she's okay with using something that's not exactly native. Ohio goldenrod has relatively surface roots, loves clay, and tolerates quite a bit of moisture. In fact, it normally grows in fens, which are alkaline, moist situations. So you have a wet spot, put in some Ohio goldenrod in the clay, and you should have great results.
All right, Marion, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. AJ emailed to ask, what sort of meadow grasses or prairie flowers can be planted in a septic drain field without impacting the drain field?
Oh, this is a great question. Okay. Generally speaking, you want to shoot for the lower, for the not so deep rooted plants, for instance, and it depends upon what the drain field is covered with. If it is just the remnant backfill, sand and gravel backfill, then you can use little bluestem, shortgrass, prairie dropseed, side oats grama, and purple lovegrass, some of the grasses we talked about earlier. If it's a heavy clay soil, then prairie drop seed is going to be your best bet. It will grow in heavy clay. But a lot of times what happens is the septic field is put in. They put in the 4, 5, 6 feet of backfill sand and gravel, and then they put 6 inches of topsoil over it, which means that the grasses that, or flowers that need really dry conditions are stymied because now you've got this loamy soil over the sandy soil. Now you have a schizophrenic soil. It doesn't know what it is. I'm a loam, I'm a sand. I'm a sand, I'm a loam. I don't know who I am. And so the plants that would normally grow in the sandy soil don't grow in the loamy soil, and the plants that grow in the loamy soil don't grow in the sandy soil. So it's really complicated. But prairie drop seed can tolerate that situation. So those are just some grasses, and there are a number of flowers that will grow in that situation. And here's a really interesting story is I put septic, just a prairie mix on top of the septic system that was built here at the office in 1982. And it performed beautifully for 30-something years. And then the tank cracked.
Oh.
And so we had to replace the tank.
Oh.
Well, yes, yes. Okay, so the tank was 30-something years old. So they come out, and then they say, whoa, well, we just looked up the design of your septic system, and the depth to modeling, M-O-T-T-L-I-N-G, which indicates the seasonal high water table, well, the rules have changed, regulations have changed since your septic tank was installed, and now you're too, it's the depth of modeling is too close to your septic system, so now you have to replace the septic system with a mound system. So that's going to be an extra $10,000. I'm like, man, you're why people hate government. Dang, nothing. So they dug up this whole septic system that had worked perfectly, and they got down there, and it had this prairie over. Everybody's, oh, the roots are going to clog the pipes. No. I talked to these guys in the DNR when DNR used to regulate septic systems, and they said they had exhumed over 100 septic systems, and never once had they found herbaceous roots clogging them, like prairie flowers and grasses. Trees, shrubs, oh yeah, all kinds of stuff, but never. So here's the test. They exhumed our 32-year-old septic system that had a prairie on it for 32 years, and they said it was as good as the day it was installed.
Oh.
So we spent 10 grand for nothing.
Well, you learned that it was as good as the day it was installed.
Yes, that's right. It was a $10,000 lesson. I mean, you know, that's great, Larry. Thank you. Boy, you know, that's what I love about you. You always look on the bright side.
Oh, my goodness
anyway,
me. Well.
So, yes, do not fear the prairie plants on the septic system. Just stay away from the taprooted ones, just in case.
Mary emailed to warn people about oxeye sunflowers. She's battling them in her meadow and wanted everyone to be aware.
Yes, oxeye sunflower can be quite rapacious by seeds. And if you notice, for those of you who have purchased my book, The Gardener's Guide to Prairie Plants, we list the aggressiveness of every species, whether it's aggressive by seed or aggressive by creeping rhizomes. And they're listed by high, medium, and low. And generally speaking, oxeye sunflower is not a good garden plant. It's great in the meadow where it's in competition, especially if you have tall grasses that can keep it under control. But there are certain plants that are simply not recommended for gardens because on their report card it says, does not play well with others. And oxeye sunflower is one of those. Also, a creeping rhizomatous species like some of the sunflowers. Okay, some of the other sunflowers, the native sunflowers, not the oxeye sunflower, which is a Heliopsis. Then you have the Helianthus, which are the true sunflowers. Those all creep by rhizomes, and they can take over and form big patches. If you have an area that you want a solid cover to prevent erosion, put in some of the native sunflowers. They will completely occupy that location, and the birds love the seeds. So, yeah, watch out for oxeye sunflower. And there's a few others, too. Bergamot creeps by rhizomes. Not the best garden plant. Great for butterflies, but can be a little aggressive.
Neil, on that happy note, thank you so much for joining in today. Really appreciate it, and I'll look forward to our next visit. Thank you.
Larry, it's always great, Larry. Thank you so much for having me on the program.
Neil DeBoe, president of Prairie Nursery. His book, co-authored, The Gardener's Guide to Prairie Plants. And by way of full disclosure, we should mention that Prairie Nursery is one of WPR's many business sponsors. Coming up, we're going to take a look at the whole seed catalog. I'm Larry Mueller. Great to have you with us for Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here. You know, if you're like most gardeners, you're always on the lookout for new varieties. And next on Garden Talk, we have a whole catalog of great and many unusual seeds to tell you about. Back with us, one of the leaders in the heirloom seed movement, Jer Gettle, founder of Baker Creek Heirloom Seeds. And we'll talk to him about the latest edition of his absolutely fantastic seed catalog, and we'll hear about a few of his favorite new varieties. And of course, we want to hear from you. Have you found a great heirloom variety? Have you worked with Baker Creek Heirloom Seeds in the past? You can join in with your questions. The number to call, 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you can send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Jer Gettle, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Oh, good to be here on a windy, chilly morning, or afternoon, actually.
Well, I'll tell you what, it's always great to see your catalog. How's the seed business going? Are people still as excited to grow their own food as they were during the pandemic?
A lot of people, I'd say the same volume. It's just a lot of people are growing a little less than they were right in the pandemic. But overall, our numbers are staying steady. There's just some people are planting slightly less than they were through the pandemic. But overall, our numbers are going up and down all season. It's like 1 week it'll be, you know, 30-40% higher than the following, and just up and down. But it's been a really busy, overall really busy season.
That's good to hear. I was wondering about, you know, there were some, a year or 2 years back, there were some shortages of seeds. Is that a problem anymore? Or
hello?
There were some problems with seeds. Are you hearing me, Jer? Oh, I think we lost Jer for temporarily. Well, I'll tell you what, we'll try to get that fixed as we talk with Jer Gettle from Baker Creek Seed Company.
I won't hold up here.
The whole seed catalog that he has, it is the one catalog that I really look forward to every year. It's this year's edition. Yeah, they call it the world's largest seed catalog, 532 pages long. And what I like about the catalog, well, the photography of the vegetables and flowers is fantastic. But I also like the stories. I mean, you can read this thing almost like a novel in places, because it tells the stories of so many of the folks who Jer, you know, he gets a lot of his own seeds. He certainly grows his own seeds a lot, but he gets seeds from all over the world, and that's why I always love talking to him. And I think Jer, I think we got you fixed again, did we not? We got you back. No, he's not. I think he's there, but he's not hearing us. So we'll see if we can get that. We'll see if we can get that fixed, because I really wanted to talk with him about a lot of the plants and the seeds that he's got for sale this year. And along with the stories of the people who grow the seeds that supply Jer and become part of his catalog, there are other kinds of stories as well. There are recipes that you're going to find. I found one that I thought, well, I got to try this, a vegan spinach dip as an example of one of the recipes. But there's also a corn pie in here that that intrigued me. I spent some time in Nicaragua, so I was happy to see that there was some Nicaragua pepper soup in this year's catalog. And I'm going to give that a try, too, Nicaraguan pepper soup. Jer, are you there now?
I hopefully am. Our cellular service will hopefully hold up now. I moved places, and I'm hoping the Wi-Fi just keeps going down, so I don't know what's up. So,
well, tell us about this, your seeds and what makes them special.
I guess the biggest thing is all the stories that are attached to the seeds. All traditional heirloom seeds, which are seeds passed down, you know, from generation to generation in most cases. And the seeds we sell come with not only family stories, but also stories of their regions, their countries, even valleys or mountains or places where they were developed. So it's basically they tell the story and history of local areas, local families, local people. And it keeps these stories alive, unlike a piece of furniture that might be passed down from family to family. These are actually one of the few living things that we can actually pass down to our kids.
Yeah, I look forward to getting your catalog every year, and partly because of the stories in addition to the seeds. And the seeds themselves, usually, I was trying to find right near the beginning, you have a little piece of, it's about our seeds. And they're non-GMO. Talk about that.
So, yeah, basically all of our seeds are non-GMO, which most home garden seeds are non-GMO. The only thing is, like a lot of the seeds, like in corn seed, if you just go into a grocery store and buy corn seed, a lot of it has been contaminated with genetically engineered crops. And home gardeners aren't technically allowed, though, to grow GMO crops because they're all patented and protected. And the problem is with the GMO crops, we feel, is them out of control, and they're being produced in a way so they can, in many cases, you can spray more chemicals on them, you can spray things on them that would kill a normal corn plant. But you know, it's changing the DNA, but it's also allowing the ability for, you know, farmers to increase the amount of pesticides and sprays they're putting on the crops. So it's not only the genetic change, it's also the amount of additional pesticides that are being used. So that's our main issue. So we test all of our corn. That's the main crop that is easy to contaminate every year. And then we spot test other crops as well. So to make sure we're not selling anything that's even contaminated with a trace of genetic engineering, we do the best we can to make sure the seed are pure and true to type. And, you know, old fashioned varieties like, you know, our grandparents would have grew.
And I know you try to you follow the rules when it comes to selling seeds with germination, at least within some minimum government standards.
Yeah, we follow the federal standards for seeds. The germination is meeting the federal standard in most cases. It's quite a bit enough.
Yeah, absolutely. There are. And the countries, how many countries do you work with?
As far as shipping seeds, we've shipped seeds to over 150 different countries over the years. But in general, as far as where we get seeds from and collect seeds from, we've probably collected seeds from around 100 different countries, not necessarily us personally, but either us or our families or our friends or employees. And then people that we know, you know, through the whole seed industry. So right now, I think we have seeds from about 100 different countries that we offer. And then oftentimes we produce seed and get it and try to tell the story of the seed.
And as I look through it, there are so many areas that intrigue me. Peppers. Pages and pages of peppers in the catalog, 35 to be exact, I think. Why is there so much interest in growing all these varieties?
Peppers just year after year have been one of our top-selling categories, especially hot peppers. Hot peppers has just seen continuous growth ever since we started the seed company. And actually, you know, 27 years ago when we started, the amount of hot peppers available was greatly, you know, reduced in this country compared to what it is now. So it's the demand has just continued to increase. More and more gardeners, you know, love hot, spicy food as well as peppers in general, sweet peppers as well. So it's just been a continual trend.
What are some of, I was going to say the most popular, but I'm going to ask you, what are some of your favorite varieties?
Oh, my favorite peppers, in general, that's a hard one to choose. Probably my favorite pepper, one of, near the top anyway, is the orange spice jalapeno. It's it's a green jalapeno, and then it turns sweet and orange as it ripens, but it's still spicy. It's not a it's a mild spice. So you get a mild spicy jalapeno with a really sweet orange pepper taste. So that's probably my favorite, just general purpose, you know, not too spicy, not too mild. You still get a little bit of a kick. So it's perfect for making like a fresh salsa. But it's hard to pick on pepper, let alone, you know, the whole catalog in general. It's but that's definitely one of my favorites.
Jerry Gettle, founder of Baker Creek Heirloom Seeds, we're talking about his 2025 whole seed catalog for 2025. And I hope you'll join in if you had some experience with the Baker Creek. I know a lot of people listening have. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. Or you could email the email address talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on WPR News. Great to have you with us for Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here. Just a quick note, next week on the show, we'll be talking about growing berries, and Vijay Pandian comes back for that. So it's great to have him back as well. Right now, we're taking a look at seeds and talking the whole seed catalog with our guest, Jerry Gettle, who is founder of Baker Creek Heirloom Seeds. Questions for him or maybe an experience to share? I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email us the email address talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Just because I had some muskmelon not long ago, I just had a question about melons, and there's some beauties in your catalog. You've got one that is listed as your most popular melon. Kajari,
yeah, that's been our most popular probably for about 5 years now, and it's just become by far our best selling. It outsells everything else by far, and a really productive, really beautiful little melon, and it comes from India, but it does real right through the summer. We've had them produced for like 3 months straight before. They're relatively early, and they're small, so they're convenient for like one or two people. They're, you know, like a 1 to 2 pound melon, usually sometimes 3, but usually average around that 1.5, 2 pound range.
They're absolutely beautiful, and they must taste pretty good too.
Yeah, they taste like a kind of a cross between a really good traditional, you know, muskmelon and, you know, with like honeydew-like flavor. So kind of in between honeydew and cantaloupe. As long as they don't get too much water, they're like all melons. They're really sweet. As long as that, you know, you don't have too much rain, they ripen really, really sweet, and they just produce continuously for us here anyway.
Yeah. Chris in Green Bay has a comment for us. Let's go there. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Larry, and to your guest also. I just have a comment about one of Baker Creek's workers there, Ryan Schumacher. He's become kind of a seed rock star in our house, and I just wanted to say that we really enjoy his short videos, and he makes something like seeds that are kind of uninteresting, very interesting. So I just wanted to pass that on.
Oh, well, Jared, nice words there.
Yeah, everybody, we get a lot of good comments on his videos. I make videos with him about 2 weeks every month, so it's always fun to have him down, and it's always fun to get comments about the different videos, so appreciate that.
Yeah, thanks, Chris. Appreciate the call. Bree in Door County, we'll go to you next. Hi, Bree.
Hi. I had a question about pepper seeds. I actually purchased some from Baker Creek along with some others. Normally, I have my seeds started, my pepper seeds started by Valentine's Day. However, I have had a busy spring. I haven't gotten to planting my pepper seeds yet, and I was wondering if I still had time to plant them indoors.
Oh, yeah, still plenty of time. It's a good time to plant them now. I wouldn't wait too much longer, but if you wait longer, you'll get a later crop. But if you get them in now, you won't hardly notice much difference. You might be a week later. But it's still in March. It's a perfect time to, even early April, you'll be fine. If you plant them now, you could be setting them out, you know, the middle of May, and or late May, and you'll be fine.
Yeah, and that'd be about the time to do it in Door County anyway, if I'm not mistaken. Bree, thank you very much for calling. You can join in too, 800-642-1234, email to talk@wpr.org. I mentioned 35 pages of peppers in your catalog. You must have even more pages of tomatoes. How do you keep them all straight?
Tomatoes are always a challenge. It's always hard to pick which ones to list in the catalog because there's just so many. And there's so many we could be offering. But so every year we try to pick out our favorites and then always add some new favorites as well. But it's always a challenge because we could fill the whole catalog entirely just with tomatoes. But it's always a balancing act trying to figure out which ones to add each year.
The one that intrigued me was the Black Beauty. That's a dark-skinned tomato.
Yeah, it's a beautiful tomato, and it will vary anywhere from like 30% black skin to 100%, depending on the amount of light and also on the season. But sometimes you'll get ones that are oftentimes you'll get ones that are totally, you know, almost 100% black skin. And they have a really great taste, too. It's just a really pretty tomato.
Yeah, I really liked it just because it was so unusual and be something that would be a conversation piece if anybody shows up to look at your garden. What about
They're definitely striking.
Yeah. What about starting tomatoes seeds at this point?
Right now is actually perfect for where you guys are at. Even here in Missouri, we're still starting tomatoes. We usually only start the tomatoes about 4 weeks before we put them outside, unless you want to transplant them into a bigger pot. But if you're just starting them in small six packs and you have a nice warm sunny environment where they're going to, you know, grow in a southern windowsill or a sunroom or a greenhouse, right now is about the perfect time to start them. We actually usually don't start them till if we're putting them outside, actually right about the 1st of April, because otherwise they tend to get too big and leggy. And I just like putting them in when they're rather small. They tend to take off better than if you get them a bit leggy and overgrown. And also, oftentimes we will direct seed tomatoes if we run short on time too. You know, just put them in just right after the last frost, and they will be about 2 weeks behind your plants that you plant. But sometimes it works if you don't have time to start them.
I'm wondering about the catalog, just as an aside. I love this catalog, and I get it in December usually, and earlier in December, as a matter, or maybe mid December. But it is such a treat to read. You can almost read it like a book. Not a novel, but a really nice book itself. Who puts this together for you? I mean, you obviously are a big role in it, but how does it all get put together?
It's a team effort. We work with we started working with a designer who is also customers, Bakersfield, California, and then a designer in Baltimore, Maryland. And then our team here on the ground works and provides photos and descriptions and data and information back and forth to these two people. One starts in the front of the catalog and one starts in the back. And by the middle of summer, it's all ready to go again. So,
well, it's got to be an amazing process to get this done. How many do you ship? I mean, a lot of them go to bookstores.
Yeah, we send out, I think this year we did about 200 and some thousand of the big catalogs, and then about, a little over like 1.2 million of the regular smaller catalogs. So the bigger catalogs we do just over 200,000 on.
Yeah. Well, I get an extra one always, and that goes to a good friend of mine who's a gardener, and she gets her Christmas present every year is the whole seed catalog.
Oh, cool. Yeah.
Which I think she loves to get. I was looking through the readings. One of the stories had to do with Lucy Hutchings in the UK. And it was just kind of an interesting story to learn about her own seed program and how she provides seeds to you.
Yeah, definitely. So many different people like her, people in Japan and India and just all over, everywhere from overseas to right here, you know, local neighbors. But so many different people love, you know, producing seeds, growing seeds, you know, sharing seeds. So it's a big network of, you know, literally thousands of people who we work with, either finding seeds, looking for seeds, you know, mostly just hobbyists, people that want to help us out and find something new for us. So every year we get, literally, we trial, you know, 1,000 new seeds every year.
And Lucy mentioned that she says the young people in the UK learn from video. They don't learn from print as much. So they have a QR code on the back of their seed packs. And you can that takes the QR code takes people to videos relating to the planting and preparation and so forth of the seeds, which I think is pretty cool.
Definitely, definitely a lot more. Like when we started the business, nobody was watching YouTube videos or anything online, really. It was all just, you know, still catalogs were, you know, the only way people, or magazines pretty much. And then within a few years, it all has switched. And now, you know, our number one way to get new customers is video advertising. And it's totally, and video, not just advertising, but video, social media, YouTube. But especially social media, so many gardeners learn about gardening from, you know, the internet now versus, you know, printed materials.
So the seeds that you got this year, some of the new ones that you really find striking, can you fill us in on some of those?
Oh, there's so many. One area where we got a whole bunch of new varieties is we've got quite a few new German zinnias, and zinnias are probably our most popular, besides sunflowers and zinnias for flower categories. But we've got a whole series of new zinnias. That's one area. We've got, you know, some really cool ones on. I'm trying to think of all the different areas. There's a little bit here and there scattered throughout the catalog. We've got some really, the other thing I was really excited about, probably the most exciting thing this year, is amaranth, which a lot of people in the U.S. only grow as like they might have grew the love slice bleeding years ago or some amaranth in their ornamental garden. But we've got a bunch. We had one or two, and now we've gotten several more of ornamental but also edible amaranths that are like spinach, but they take the heat all summer long. They're more pest resistant than spinach, but they don't bolt. Like, you know, spinach goes to seed right away.
Yeah.
Whereas the amaranth, when you cook up these tender varieties, they taste just as good as, in fact, in the summertime, they're way better. So that's probably the most exciting.
Oh, that.
If we have white and red and pink.
Oh, it sounds wonderful. Say, do you try the recipes in your book? By the way, I see the saffron corn pie looks pretty good to me.
A lot of the recipes in the book, the people when they made them, they would I'd be working in the garden or whatever, and they'd give me a piece to try. So most of the recipes I try as they make. So, and so I get to try most of them. There's a few that I'm gone, and when they're making it, I miss them. But most of the recipes, it's always fun to be able to taste the different things that different people are making here on the farm.
You guys, it's a kind of a family operation, isn't it? I mean, there's a great photo of you with your family there on the inside front cover.
Our family, and then kind of, you know, our staff is kind of like family too after a while. Everybody, you know, a lot of the people have been here for years and years, so it's kind of, some of the employees have been here, you know, going on 16, 17, 18 years, so it's become kind of like a big family of, you know, our family personally, but then also the staff. So people that have been here a while, they kind of, they become kind of like your relatives after a while, so.
Say, are you having an event again this summer at your place?
We have an event coming up in early April, an event coming up in early May, and then an event in early October. And I can't remember the exact dates off the top of my head. I think April is April 6 and 7, but then after that, the other ones are, I forgot the dates. Each event will be about around 9,000 people at each event. So it basically fills up our farm for a couple of days.
I know people from Wisconsin visit. Jerry, always a pleasure. Thank you so much for taking time to be with. Appreciate it.
Really appreciate it.
Yeah, Jerry Gettle, founder of Baker Creek Heirloom Seeds. And if you type that into the search engine, you're going to be able to find out the timing of those events that he just briefly mentioned there right at the end. Thanks for joining us today for Garden Talk. This and all our shows, a team effort. Our producers, Clara Neipert and Joel Patnod. Our technical directors are Lee Rayburn and Jeff Robbins on today. And our executive producer is Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for listening to Garden Talk, and stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News.